bottle of Coors Light. I had to get over here to... Can y'all hear me okay?
Yeah.
It's guys, it is kind of emotional. I've been coming to this conference for a long, long time, and it's amazing how many buds I've made over the years here. How many of y'all remember the first time somebody asked you to go to man-to-man, the conference like that? I remember when the first year I got sober, this guy said, "Hey, I want you to go to this men's conference out in Brownwood," and I said, "I'd rather cut my dick off with a dull knife than to go to a man's conference. I mean, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that." But by the next year, I'd matured a little bit, and I got a different sponsor, and we talked a bit, and I came. And other than me booking some travel on the dates over the years like that, this will be my 32nd year to be here, and it's just. Chris and I start talking about it like in October or November every year. We're already, you know, getting amped up and ready to go, and it's just pretty special. For those that I hadn't met, my name is Myers Raymer. I'm a very grateful recovered alcoholic. Such a treat. I want to thank Tim and the committees and the folks that chaired. Rick, you were Mr. Awesome last night. That may be your new rap name, Mr. Awesome. It was really cool, and my boy Chad Payne talking tomorrow. It just what a great bunch to come together and do this stuff. I want to thank Greg as a taper. I gotta tell you guys what I had never owned a speaker tape before till I came to Man to Man, and I was leaning against the wall, completely hung out, and really just kind of lost. I didn't really know who to talk to or anything like that. And the guy that was the taper, which Greg knew, the guy that was there looked at me and he said, "Son, you look like you could use some help." And I said, "Well." And he had all these tapes and stuff out there like that. They had just introduced CDs. That's how long ago it was. Most of them were cassette tapes, not 8-track tapes. Somebody said, like, and I said, I don't have a clue. And he said, "I tell you what, I'll pick them out for you. I'll give you one of them, and you can pay for the other one." And I said, "Okay." So he gave me a Bob White CD, one of the founding guys for this conference, what's his name in California? Golly, the Clancy. So it was Clancy, and it just sort of changed my whole perspective of some of that stuff. And I played those things until I just flat wore them out. Pretty amazing. I don't want to spend a bunch of time talking about story stuff because I've got to. Let me get this. I'm a trained professional. I'm watching this clock like a. Like a hawk. I don't have a lot of story. Most of my story is after I got sober, which is really weird, I think, but it's the truth. I come from a long line of drunks in my family. We used to always laugh, if you kick the Raymer family tree, little drunks and dope fiends fall out all over the ground. I mean, it's just like, it's just kind of crazy. And so my dad was an alcoholic, and Chris, he was. Chris actually had sobered up 2 months before I did, which he'll tell you really quick when you meet him. Yeah, I'm too much more sober than Myers is. I'm 3 minutes older than he is, so I'll throw that in there just. But y'all should sense the wisdom already there. You know that 3 minutes is a lot. I sobered up in a group north of Dallas, and the nicest bunch of people in the universe. They truly were, and still are, I guess. But it was a weird dynamic, and I didn't know really how to deal with it. We had 32 meetings a week, and they were all discussion meetings. We had no literature-based meetings, no big book stuff, no just a lot of meetings. I'm going to 6 meetings a week, and it's just like. There was a guy in that meeting, his name was Horse Jim. I don't even know what his name was, Horse Jim. And he'd always introduce himself the same way. "My name's Jim, and I'm sober today." And that was it. And that's how many of y'all remember an old saying, "We teach what we're taught"? And so if you're in a dynamic where that's what they do, and everything seems to swing into the I'm sober one day at a time, and so it's all groovy. Check the meeting off the list and go on down the road again like that. It was sort of a, I mean, I'm sitting there breaking my arm, patting myself on the back because I'm going to 6 meetings a week. Now listen, y'all, I have a sponsor in name only. I've never worked the steps, don't know anything about the basic text, and it's crazy. And I did that weird kind of little bell curve thing. I got better, sober, no booze, no dope, no nothing. I'm okay for about 3 years. And then at the end of 3 years, I start going back the other direction. And now I'm a hot mess at home. My wife is freaking out when I'm around. My kids are scared of me because they don't know who's coming home from those A&A meetings. They don't know anything about what I'm doing. And it's a bit terrifying. And some of y'all have experienced that. That's the only reason that I even mention this stuff. Some of y'all have had that experience of being in situations where you're sober, quote unquote, one day at a time, but where the emotional part's not kicking in anywhere, and you're sort of coming apart. Later, somebody would say, Myers, didn't you recognize restless, irritable, and discontent? And I said, no, dude, the only way I'm going to recognize that is if I'd read the text. And I hadn't. So I didn't know. I thought this was just about my problem is booze and Canadian whiskey and methamphetamines. That's what my problem is, you see? And if I get rid of that, I'm going to be glorious. It's going to be fine. And it was for a little bit, and then it wasn't. And that's the part that's always troubling in some of this. I won't go into a whole bunch of stuff, but I'm having anxiety attacks at 4 years sober, and they give me a bunch of meds for the anxiety stuff, and we can treat that a little bit. And then the depression comes into the picture, and now I'm fighting this depression that is absolutely killing me. I can't work. I can't function. It's just getting real bleak. These suicidal tendencies are coming back almost every day. I'm trying to deal with how to deal with all that stuff. I'm trying to treat this internal condition with y'all. Some of y'all think it's stupid. I'm eating a half a gallon of Bluebell ice cream every night. And it worked for a little bit. I mean, I'm telling you, like that, I got my neck is all big like this. I'm built like a jackrabbit, and all of a sudden I'm just getting this big face and just... it's not working real good. I'm buying a million things I don't need. I'm buying clothes I don't wear. I'm buying music I don't listen to. I learned how to fly after I got sober, and I bought an airplane, and then I had to buy another airplane, and then a little while later, I bought another one. Now, guys, why does a man need 3 airplanes? I'm just saying. I'm buying tools. I don't even know what they are, y'all. They used to call me Myers the tool whore. And Chris used to make fun of me. He used to laugh about that. And about 6 months ago, I asked him to come over to the barn and help me sort out my tools. And I'm talking for 4 or 5 hours. He's sitting in there going, what the? Why do you need 130 screwdrivers? Some of them are badass, I got to tell you. If you just like that. Some of y'all can relate, but guys, I mean, it's like when I die, they're going to go through my crap like that, and Jimmy, my son-in-law, he's going to be going through there going, why did Myers need 10 hacksaws? I mean, why? It's just, I just need one more. I'll just go, you know, like this. I'm trying to... Some of y'all can absolutely relate. Like, you certainly can. Anyhow... I will say this real quick, because Chris saved my life twice in AA. He took me to my very first AA meeting, and I fell in love with those folks. And then 3 weeks shy of 7 years sober, I'm a suicidal mess, and I'm talking to Chris on the telephone. He's now moved to the Hill Country. I'm still living in Dallas. And he said, Myers, you do realize you're in trouble. And I said, I am. I know that. I'm not trying to play games. I just don't know. And he said, what did that old guy that I turned you on to, what did he ever say? And I said, well, I never called him. And it's like silence on the other end of the phone. And I said, Chris, are you there? And he goes, yeah. I'm here, but I don't know what I can do to help you. I tried to get you connected with this guy, and Chris had met this old guy named Cliff Bishop, who passed away years ago in Dallas. They had a book study. In those days, there were two meetings. Later, we had one more meeting, but it was an epic meeting there in the Dallas area. And so anyway, I finally, out of desperation, I called the guy. I'll make this real quick. It was just a weird meeting. He asked me a few questions about AA, of which I did not know the answer to, none of them. I mean, come on, guys, it's embarrassing for me to even stand up here and tell you like this. I'm 3 weeks shy of 7 years sober in these rooms, and I can't tell you who the co-founders of Alcoholics Anonymous are. People are going, no, there's no way you're that stupid. Yes, I'm the poster boy of stupid. I make every mistake known to man in this thing, and all I'm doing is following this dialogue in the meetings. You know, you just keep coming back. You're the most important man in the room. You just need to, all this, all the little aphorisms on the wall like this, but I don't know anything about what recovery looks like. I don't know anything about any of that except just trying to stay sober. If you want to see your program turn into a burden, live that life. Do that. And there's so much more. But Mark Houston, years ago, he used to, in a talk that he did, he went, I smell more. And I thought, you know, that's kind of interesting. Because the reality of it was is that I always suspected that there was more about this thing, about the program and about recovery, because I'm able to see some of these people and the way they live their life and what they're doing like that. And it's sort of an amazing deal. Let me ask you a question. How many of y'all have ever heard of a guy named Alan McGinnis? He wrote a brochure. He did a talk, and they took the transcript off that and turned it into a brochure called A Member's Eye View of AA. Like that. And there's one little piece in here I want to read to you like that. What I want you to remember before I read this, it's real short. What I want you to remember is this was written 60 years ago, 60 years ago, 60 plus years ago. But McGinnis was trying to get us to see some things, and I think it was important. There's a widely held belief in AA that if a newcomer will simply continue to attend meetings, something will finally rub off on you. And the implication, of course, is that the something which rubs off will be the so-called miracle of AA. Now, there is no doubt in my mind that many people in AA accept this statement quite literally. I've observed them over the years. They faithfully attend meetings, faithfully waiting for something to rub off. The funny part about it is that the something that is rubbing off of them is death. They sit there week after month after year while mental, spiritual, and physical rigor mortis slowly sets in. Ow. I mean, you read that and you feel like you've just been bitch slapped like that. Listen, because here's the deal, y'all. If just being sober one day at a time is enough, rock on. I mean, seriously, rock on. But what if it's not? Well, what if you're like me and you're struggling with this emotional piece of this thing and you find that there's... Anybody that starts in the program, that starts down this path, working out of the text, will see this really quick. I mean, really quick. Because Bill and the first 100, they painted this picture as they were writing this. They painted this picture of how transformational this whole program could be. That it could change everything about who you are and what you are and how you look at life and how you deal with people around you. And this, I mean, this is a big, big deal. It's just... Some of you may... anybody got a big book with them like that? Gee, I'll read it. You don't even have to look. I'm flipping over to page 75. I want to read something. I'm going to 6 meetings a week. I don't understand anything about recovery. And then one day in that book study with these old timers, we're reading this little Fifth Step Promises in the center of that page like that. I'm going to skip down a little bit. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. Now, we may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we began to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we're on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. y'all see the difference? Y'all see the I mean, they're explaining something here that is like otherworldly. Wait a minute. Standing in the sunlight of the Spirit? I mean, how does this line up with go to 6 meetings a week? It doesn't. I just as we've gotten older in AA, as we've progressed through this thing, we tend to look at a lot of our program, and I don't know, I'm trying not to be disrespectful, but a lot of times I think we catalog this as like AA light. If I just go to some meetings, I'll be okay. I'm not knocking meetings. I love me some meetings. Totally dig them like that. If you can go to 3 meetings a day, rock on, go. If your lifestyle will let you do that. But guys, I think a lot of you will do the same thing that I did. You'll get downrange a ways, and all of a sudden you'll find that this idea of AA stuff starts to be a burden. And you don't want to hear that again, and you don't want to hear that again, and you don't. We're sitting in a meeting. I finally left that original home group, and I started going to Primary Purpose Group Dallas. And we were sitting in a meeting one night studying some stuff. And in the book, and I'll set this down, I promise you, some of you guys don't want to hear this stuff. Two-thirds of the way down the page on page 17, this is miracle stuff. This changes everything about how you look at what it is that we're doing. The feeling of having shared a common peril is one element, the powerful cement which binds us. We all totally dig that, okay? We're all copacetic on all that kind of stuff. The fact that I've got a story, and Al's got a story, and Jason's got a story like that. And these are things that connect us. That's a necessary piece of this thing. But stick with me. He kind of messed it up. I kind of wished he'd stop right there, because then the meeting thing would be groovy. Where he goes after that is, but that in itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. Oh, why did he say that? The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we've discovered a common solution. So here's the $64,000 question. I mean, whether you're an old guy in these rooms or whether you're a brand new guy in these rooms, the question that begs to be asked is, am I okay with the text? Do I understand what the big book was trying to teach us in the way that it was trying to teach us? Look at how many reoccurring themes there are in the big book. And if you're a big book study guy, you'll begin to put them together and connect the dots. And it's amazing, like that, it's amazing because they painted this picture that this idea of recovery was so much deeper, so much broader, so much more life-changing than just going to a bunch of meetings. Cliff Bishop was sponsored by a guy named Joe McQuaney, and so you can kind of see where this all was going on this deal. And there were some key moments in this thing over a period of a couple of years that changed everything about how I looked at this program. It affected my life on a level that even today, it's hard to explain. I was in a Bible study with some guys a couple of weeks ago, and this guy goes, they talk about miracles in the Bible, but I don't think I've ever seen a miracle. And I remember smiling at another guy that's in that Bible study that's also in AA. I remember looking at him and grinning. And one of the other guys said, "What are y'all grinning about?" And I said, "I couldn't, if we had 3 hours, I couldn't count all the miracles I've seen in AA. I've seen tens of thousands of dumpster fires that should have been locked up or dead, that got to walk free and clear of this and live a life so amazingly transformed that nobody believed it. They didn't believe it. Their families didn't believe it. Their kids didn't believe it. Nobody believed that we could live the lives that we get a chance to live." I get so passionate about it, I get kind of, I don't want to feel like Jimmy Swaggart up here like that trying to beat people up with a big book, but by the same token, I know how many of you are newer in the program. I know how many tens of thousands of people have come to our fellowship and not found what they wanted, not found what they needed. And I just wish that maybe we could lean into the idea that if we spend a little more time studying the basic text, we'd be a little safer in the message that we carry. We teach what we're taught. Let me ask you, how many of y'all have ever listened to a band called Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young? Let the taping record show. Listen, I've done talks where nobody raised their hand. It was just like going, really, guys? Am I that old? It's just like the in one of the songs that they did years ago, a billion years ago, there was a line in that song that said, confusion has its cost. And it really struck me when I listened to it after I sobered up, because the reality of this stuff is that there is a lot of confusion sometimes in what you're doing. If you don't believe it, do me a solid. Next time you're in a meeting by yourself, or you're just sort of sitting there chilling and waiting, and people are getting ready to start the meeting like this, close your eyes for just a minute. Just close your eyes and listen to what you're hearing in the meeting. Just listen to what people are saying. Let's pretend that Jack is a brand new cat, brand new, okay? And Jason starts sharing like this, and he shares how his sponsor is going to get him through the work, and they're going to get done in 30 to 45 days. He's going to be through the work, and it's going to be badass. It's going to be pretty cool. He's pretty excited about it like that. The very next guy that shares is Tim. And so Tim goes, well, you know, my sponsor, he's got me working the steps, and we're going to do one step a month, and so I should be finished in a year or a year and a half. Now, so stick with me, okay? You're just sitting there listening to what's being said like that. Here's the dilemma. What do you believe? How do you deal with that kind of stuff like that? Tim's sitting there scratching, going like, I don't know. I love both those men. They're both, I mean, these are badass members of AA like that. I love them both, but I heard a conflicting piece of information. This is difficult. So let me just ask you this question. What lines up with the basic text more? Which one lines up more with what the basic text says? Go quicker. Time is not your friend. I'm just guaranteeing you like that. Remember that little place on 24 in the italics? We won't remember with sufficient for the pain and suffering of even a week or a month ago. This lines up more like this. I'm telling you right now, guys, we all have watched folks who got better for a week or two, and then we sat there, and we watched them get sick again and go back out again, and we're just going, well, you know, they'll come back maybe. Why didn't we just step it up a little bit? I'm not trying to push stuff down people's throat, but if you got a guy that's motivated and he wants a life-changing experience like that, let's give it to him. Let's just go do it and see what happens. So the one of the things, how many of y'all ever listened to a guy named Don Pritz? He's been dead for years. That's amazing. I'm so proud of you guys like that. Don was an epic dude in AA that sobered up in the federal penitentiary system in the 60s. And he was a pretty amazing dude like this. And one of the things that always got me about it, like in one of his early talks, he said, I'm concerned. Now, this is Don talking. He goes, I'm concerned that these days we see more and more people talking about sobriety and less people talking about recovery. There's a huge difference between just being sober one day at a time and living a life that has been transformed, that what recovery actually looks like. Recovery is a great deal. I mean, there's a lot of freedom in that kind of stuff. I can go where I want to go, do what I want to do, whatever. I had this guy one night call me, and he's just in tears, and I said, it took me a minute to figure out who he was, and then I said, dude, what's going on? And he said, oh, I'm just pretty upset. And I said, what are you upset about? And he said, well, my daughter's getting married. And I've got three daughters. And I'm looking, I'm going like, well, I don't understand. Why are you upset? He said, well, they've decided they're going to serve champagne at the reception, so I can't go. And there's a piece of me wanting to go, dude, you're stupid as hell. Quit that shit. I mean, it's just like, but I didn't. But the point is that sometimes I think we need to look at the big picture of our program and ask ourselves, are we living a life that's like bondage? Is it a burden to do what it is that we do, or is it not? Or do we know what freedom is about? Chris and I were coming back from Denmark one time, and we had a 13-hour layover in Amsterdam. And so if you can get a hold of somebody else's phone, Google Amsterdam Red Light District. Yeah, don't do it on your phone, okay? It's just like, there's probably no crazier place on the face of the earth, but I mean, you have an airport with a train station on one side of it, and you get to the other side of the train station, and it's Amsterdam Red Light District is right there, and there's every kind of whack, crazy stuff going on in the universe. Guess what? We weren't going, Brother Chris, we can't go because we're going to be triggered if we go over there like that. No. We went and had fun, laughed our asses off. The only thing I can remember about that night was I laughed so much I thought I was going to throw up on the street. Serious. I mean, it's just, that's the kind of freedom that I want. That's the kind of freedom that these cats were talking about that I think is so so amazingly important. I was having breakfast one time with Joe McQuaney, and he had come to Dallas from Arkansas, and we had this. We did it three or four different times, and he would sit there, and we'd be visiting back and forth with each other. He was sort of an amazing cat, and Joe looked at me and he said, "Myers," he said, "you know, I find it interesting. You always seem to make this whole idea of recovery look really complicated." And Clifford had been my sponsor for probably 4 months by then. And I said, it is. It's pretty complicated. And he goes, "Well, no, it's not." And I said, "Well, tell me what it is then." And he said, "Myers," he said, "I know that you're going to struggle with this, but you got to believe me when I tell you this thing. This thing is 100% about how much time you're spending with God's kids and how much time you're spending with God." And I went, "Get out of here. It's got to be a lot more than that." He said, no. This is the truth, and the reality of that is it's the truth. I can't begin to tell you how many men I've sponsored over the years that have never sponsored anybody, ever sponsored anybody, and you wonder why things are crazy. But let me just ask you. I got a guy right now that I'm working with that's been sober for 27 years. He's a bit of a fruitcake. He's kind of crazy, but he's never sponsored anybody in 27 years. So let me ask you, if you had to go to meetings for 27 years, what would you talk about if you weren't talking about sponsorship, if you weren't talking about that amazing change that happens when you go do that stuff? I mean, it's like, this is like magic stuff when we do this. And it's always kind of, I told him, I said, "Dude, I want you to hang with me for a while, buddy. I'll take you to where we're doing H&Is and carry the message like that. We're going to find you a protege. We're going to find you somebody to work with like that." It took a week, that whole week, but we did. And I've never seen a man's life change like that. Now listen, he never said one word to me. He never said anything like, "Oh, this is the coolest," or this kind of stuff like that. But his wife called me. And then later at a birthday night, walked up to me and hugged me and said, "I got to tell you right now that all I wanted to do was cut his junk off because of the way that he was, and his life is completely different today." And it still doesn't make any sense intellectually. I don't know what it is that y'all did, but it's a pretty amazing life. And I'm going like, "I'll take that cred. That's a good thing." Like I'm almost, at this point, I'm almost 10 years sober, and I've never sponsored anybody. And so I'm 100% convinced, because I heard a guy from a podium say, "You know, there are good 12-steppers and bad 12-steppers, and if you're not a good 12-stepper, you shouldn't be doing that. Let somebody else do that." That's what he said. And I could have kissed that guy that night. I thought he was just like, "God dang, thank you. I'm so glad I don't have to do that, because it's going to be real hard." And I'm sitting in a meeting one night, and I'm looking at the faces of the people in that meeting at Primary Purpose Group Dallas. Rick was in there that night, and I'm looking around the room, and all of a sudden, I look at Clifford, and I look back at these other men, and I'm going, "I'm still not like them." Now, and by this time, I know the book. I'm digging it. It's pretty cool. But I remember asking Clifford what that night. I said, "Clifford, can I talk to you after the meeting for just a second?" And he goes, "Yes, Myers." And I mean, they're kind of done with me. I've been there almost 2 years, and I'm still playing games with this stuff. He takes me to this little back room, and we talk for a minute like this. And I said, "Clifford, I'm still not like y'all, am I?" And he said, "Oh, no, not even close." And I said, "What do I do?" And I'll never forget it like that. Guys, he takes his glasses off like this, and he goes, He said, Myers, I want to tell you one more time, and then if you don't do it, I'll see you later. You got to go. And I'm thinking he means go until the next meeting on Thursday night, and then all of a sudden it hit me like a ton of bricks. He was saying, you got to go, like, away from here. And I went, I'm all ears. What do I do? And he said, go get busy carrying the message and helping other people. And I just, what do you want me to do? And I said, we're going to go to Salvation Army tomorrow night. And I said, I know, I was going to drive you. That's what I did. I used to drive him. He was real old when I got hooked up with him. And I'd drive him over there, and then I'd set his books in the room where we were doing the talks, and then I would go back outside and get on my phone and play games and, you know, wave at people, and I just like, but I never shared anything, and I never. I don't want to mess them up. They know what they're doing like that. So he said, all right, you go over there tomorrow night, and I'm going to get you involved, and you're going to read for me, and we're going to get you involved. And I said, that's a deal. I'll do it. I get over there, Salvation Army in Houston, right on Harry Hines. It's hot as fuck. It's just crazy over there. And I remember walking into the building, and I'm looking around, and Clifford's car is not there, and Ed Posey, his car is not there. And I'm just looking around for anybody else to do the meeting, and then I'm just going like, they're not here. Now listen, we had 52 commitments a week in Primary Purpose Group before COVID. 52 commitments to carry the message other places. H&I's and carrying the message was sacred stuff, and we protected it like it was a vault. I mean, you don't mess with it like that. You do what you're supposed to do. And I knew that like that. And so I'm looking around, and there's nobody there. They swore up and got. They said that it wasn't a I gotcha kind of thing, but I think it was. I think that they knew that if there was somebody there, I'd find a way to back out. But nobody else showed up. And so I'm standing there. There's 170 men in that room, that big gymnasium thing, and I'm standing outside the security gate looking in going, just, damn, okay, I'll do it. And then I go in, and I knew right where we were. We did the meeting like this, and we got done. And after the meeting, this guy goes, that was real fun. And he called me Mr. Myers. He always did for the whole time I've known that guy. He said, Mr. Myers, he said, is there any chance you could come back tomorrow night? And some of y'all know exactly where I'm standing on this thing, because there was a piece of me that went, God, nobody's ever asked me to come back. I mean, this is badass. I'm pretty excited about it like that. But there was another piece of me that was going, damn it. If I'd have just walked a little faster, I could have got all the way out and nobody would have said a word. You see? And then I could have milked that for 10 years. Yeah, I carried that message down to Sally. Yeah, that's what I thought it was going to be. And anyway... So I'll make this real quick, guys, but the next day I got up. My wife is my business partner, the brains of the operation, and 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning, I'm looking at the clock like this, and I'm kind of like, and she's going, Myers, what's going on with you today? And I said, man, I'm going back out to Salvation Army tonight. And she said, what time are you going out? I said, 7:30. And she goes, Myers, it's 11 o'clock in the morning, for crying out loud, get in the game. And I go, okay, I will. And at 1 o'clock, I looked at her, and I just waved at her, and I said, adios, I got to go get ready. And I get home, and I'm all fired up. I take a shower, get my ensemble out, what I'm going to wear, and then I take another shower, and then I'm just getting ready. It's the weirdest feeling in the whole wide world. I feel kind of electric. I don't understand any of it. I don't understand what that was about. I remember walking in the thing like this. I slide through security like I'm a pro, and I just walk into this room. And when I walk in, all of these men have just got out of dinner or wherever they were, and they're coming in the deal. And there's a bunch of them standing in the middle of this gymnasium, and there's one guy that's built like Rod, my buddy in here, like that, except he's probably 6 inches taller. This guy was absolutely huge like that, but he had the same kind of arms you got, dude. And so he's walking towards me a little too fast, and it's kind of freaking me out again a little bit like this. And as he gets right up on me, I put my hands up like this, and I kind of look this way like this, because I didn't. And he just reached down like this and scooped me up like that. He picked me up. My feet aren't even touching the ground like that, and he's just holding me. And I remember pushing back like this, and then I went, Myers, come on, don't be so. If he wanted to hurt you, he would have already hurt you. Like that. And so I remember just dropping my arms, and I just put my head down on his chest. Let me just tell you something. I wouldn't tell this to anybody but y'all. I may regret telling you this like that. But I gotta tell, I don't think I've ever been held more gently than that guy did. By any, I can tell, to this day, I can still tell you the way he smelled. He had this really soft flannel shirt. I know. I'll get some therapy. We'll deal with it. But while he's holding me up like this, he looks, hey guys. While he's holding me, he looks down, his mouth that far from my ear, and he said, "We've been looking forward to you coming back over here all day long." And I remember looking up at him, and I went, "Me too, me too." And I mean, it was just this weird kind of deal like that. And he set me down, and we started. We had us a meeting, and I tell you, I felt just like Jimmy Swaggart. I'm sweating like a pig, and I'm up here like this, just having a time with the book, and these guys are digging it, and we were laughing really hard, and we were talking about things. It was just one of those kind of magic deals. We get to the end of the meeting, getting ready to lock up, do the Lord's Prayer, which, by the way, is amazing with 170 men in that room, and I'm just sitting there. We dropped hands, and this guy goes, "Hey, Mr. Myers, is there any chance that you could sponsor me?" And this other guy goes, "Me too, me too, me too." And there were four guys that asked me to sponsor him that night. I've never sponsored one, and now I have four. It was an exciting conversation with Cliff Bishop that night on the way home. It was. And it changed everything. Those H&Is, those ability to carry the message, I did it over there for a long time. And then I switched over to Homeward Bound, which was like an amazing place that brought people in right in off the street. And it was crazy. And I did two meetings over there every week for 5 years until my daughters were getting big enough in high school that I had to kind of slow down a little bit with that. But miracle after miracle after miracle in those rooms. And you just kind of... Joe McQueenie said one night, he said, Myers, the most magic time in your life in recovery, the most magic moment is when you realize that you're in this room to feed, not be fed. And I remember looking at him, and it sunk in a little bit, and I went, yeah, I think I understand what you're talking about. I do. And because in the old days, I'm there talking with my homies, and we're having a good time, and with this kind of stuff, and I'm oblivious to anybody else that's around me. I don't know. And so but he was absolutely right. When I made that connection that I needed them more than they needed me, this was a game changer in terms of how I looked at my own recovery and how I looked at my own value within those rooms. Guys, we could talk about this for days, really. Here's the deal that always gets me. Some of us are going to wake up one day and realize it's cool to be sober. I'll always think that that's the coolest thing in the whole wide world. But let me tell you what's even cooler than being sober. What's even cooler is that a walking dumpster fire like me could actually affect change in the lives of other men. And then all of a sudden it begins to get kind of... Who knows? There was a guy in a meeting one night that we were in this book study, and he said, I want to just throw this out there. I thought it was kind of funny when somebody mentioned it. Did it ever occur to any of you guys that the reason we got sober had nothing to do with us? The reason Jason got sober had nothing to do with him. It had everything to do with who Jason could help. When you look at it from that perspective, it changes the whole dynamic about who we are and what we are and what we're here for. I love looking at it from that perspective to try to see. Okay, I got two more things I want to talk about. I promise I'll be quick about it. The, no, three things. No, no, two. I'll stop at two. I want to address the guys in this room that are have been around for a little while. You've been sober for a while. This question came up one time, and it was in, and I thought about it for weeks and weeks and weeks because it really kind of hit me. I'd been sober by that time 26, 27 years, and I remember this guy said, "How do you know if you're drifting? How do you know if where you're supposed to be?" And so the thought process was around that. And I'm going, so I want to talk for just a second about how do you what does it look like if you're drifting? Because it's easy for you to say, I'm okay. I'm sober. I'm okay. And then your family is looking at you going, no, you're not, dude. No, I mean, honest, really, just like go away. It's just like, it's interesting to look at this stuff. I think one of the greatest ways to tell because I think everybody drifts. I don't think that anybody comes in, gets strong, stays strong, and just kind of stays on that deal. I think we all get into a sweet spot, and then over a period of time, we'll drift a little bit. We'll do. Somebody sent me a news article one time from the intergroup office in Akron, Ohio, and I remember reading it on my cell phone, and then I looked at it, and then I texted them back and said, I don't see what, it's a neat article. And they go, no, it's not the article, it's stupid. Look, read the stuff at the bottom of it. And there was a little thing at the bottom of it, and it said, alcoholics, the only group of people on the face of God's green earth that takes what works and then stops doing it. And I was going like, holy cow, that's the truth. I mean, most of us have lived that kind of deal like that. Maybe not all of you, but a lot of us have been in a sweet spot where things were pretty groovy, and then we just sort of drifted sideways like this, and we don't even really know that we're doing that stuff. So here's my formula that I think works really well. Go back when you've got nothing else to do. Go back and read from the ABCs in the big book to the third step prayer. You got 2.5 pages there where Bill Wilson stops talking about alcoholism completely. He doesn't talk about any of this stuff. He just talks about and introduces us to this idea of the stage character. This is hard for some of us to do as men, to look at this stuff and see. When you read from 60 over, you read a couple of things, and then he's going to eventually introduce us to this idea that selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our problem. But right before that, he starts talking about these characters, these guys like that, these actors that want to run the whole show. Y'all, listen, I'm walking out of an AA meeting patting myself on the back because of that wonderful share in there. I'm spiritual giant doesn't do the word right. I mean, I'm something else special like that. I'm thinking I'm really hot. And then the next morning, I'm up early, I'm at the airport, and I'm flying airplanes and riding motorcycles with my homies, and we're cussing and gossiping and telling all kinds of weird stuff like that. And I've got a million of off-ramp weird stuff that we're talking about like this. And I'm going, wait a minute. Bill Wilson paints a picture that maybe what we ought to do is look at our own authenticity, our own character. I mean, most of us are so focused on the drinking stuff that we don't ever stop and think, what's my character really like? You see? I think it's important to understand. If I'm a stage character, it's not a problem if I recognize that I'm a stage character, because I've got a way to get past it. Where it gets to be a problem, it gets to be a disaster, is if you don't see it, and which gets tough. That gets tough to deal with. Another one that I think in this little piece of self-evaluation that I think is pretty cool is to go read the promises in the big book. Go read them and then ask yourself, have these promises manifested in my life? Yes or no? It's a simple deal. They either have or they have not. And if they have not, why? What is it that I'm not doing that maybe I should be doing? And I think these are big questions to ask. And it's uncomfortable to look at that kind of stuff. Guys, I'm telling you, I'm 25, 26 years in the rooms like that. And there's a ton of these things that I'm just thinking, well, you know, Bill Wilson just wrote that to sell books. He didn't really believe that you could do that. This, seriously, standing in the sunlight of the Spirit, like walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. I mean, these are heady things that we're talking about here, right? And I think it's important to actually look at that. A third way that wasn't on my original list, but a guy told me after a meeting one night, he said, "Myers, I got one more thing that I think would be good to be on that list." And I said, "Yeah, what's that?" He said, "Ask your wife." And I went, and I remember walking out and sitting in my truck, and then when I swung up in my truck and I'm looking out the window and I went, damn, he's right. I remember getting home that night and I said, "Hey, Londa, can we have a conversation about my own character and authenticity?" And she goes, "Do we have to have that conversation now?" And I said, no, actually, we don't even have to bring it up again. We're all right. Anyhow, two or three days later, she said, are you ready to have that conversation? And I went, oh, okay. And we sat down and had the conversation, guys. And I got to tell you, there's an absolute sweet spot when somebody loves you enough to tell you the truth about who you are. It's an amazing deal. If I could change anything in AA, it would be that when we give spiritual consent to people like that to tell us the truth, that we pay attention to it and look at it. And that those of us, there are a lot of us that are too scared to say something to somebody. But if you're sponsoring somebody and they're a dickhead, you need to tell them they're a dickhead. You can be nice. You can be kind about it like that. But knowing the truth is really important because it gives us a chance. Once we see it, we could admit that it's objectionable and ask God to remove it in 6 and 7 and get on down the road. It's just kind of sweet. So this is going to be really, this part of this topic is going to be really weird talking about it in some ways because I think sometimes as men in these rooms, we miss the most obvious things that we should be doing. So I want to tell you a real quick story. It's real quick. I got asked to do a talk in Dallas at a real fancy AA group. I'd never been there before. I won't tell you where they are, but they're fancy. And I remember going over there, and it was for their anniversary, and it was raining outside real bad. I was dressed just like this, and I got out from under my truck, and I ran across the parking lot, and I'm standing underneath this big awning out front, big glass wall behind there, and there's like 12 or 15 people sitting out. That was their butt hut. They were just out there smoking like that. And so I'm standing there like this, shaking the water off like this. I got my big book right here. And I kind of look around like this, and I'm just, nobody's saying anything. It's like they're real quiet. And I look back around, and I said, "Hey, is this so-and-so group?" And this guy goes, "Yeah." And I went, "Well, cool. And I'm standing there for a couple of minutes like this, and I finally said, "I think I'll go inside," because I felt like an idiot out there like that. And so I look around, and I can't find the door. And I remember the all these guys were there, and they were talking a little bit like this, and I'm looking like this, and I finally went, "Guys, I must be going blind. I may be older than I thought I was. Like, I can't find the door." And this guy is sitting there smoking a big stogie, and he points back over his head like this, and he just goes like that. And I went, "Oh, I see it. Thanks, dude. Appreciate it," like that. And there was a little latch on a door, and I just slid the whole glass wall back, and I walked in. So I walk in, sit there for 20 minutes. Not one person in that room talked to me. Not nobody. I just sat there in the room. And pretty soon, some of my homeboys from Primary Purpose came over there, came in, and we started cutting up, and, you know, we had a pretty good time. And then we did the meeting, and I did it. And so, it wasn't, 3 months later, I did a talk with Chris Schroeder at Dr. Bill's place in East Dorset, Vermont. And we did a workshop on a Friday night, all day Saturday. And then Sunday morning, we got one more workshop to do. And there's a big bike group that came in to that morning real early while we were eating breakfast. They were coming in there. There must have been 80 or 90 bikers in there like that. It was pretty exciting to see them all coming in and this kind of stuff. Again, I'm dressed just like this, and we start the meeting, and everybody's sharing just stuff and about bikes and stuff. I don't know. It was just kind of a crazy meeting. They were going to do their meeting, and then they were going to leave, and then we were going to finish the workshop like that. But I sat there for 40 minutes while they were getting their meeting set up, and nobody said anything to me. Nobody did anything like that. Nobody, I mean, I'm dressed completely different like that. And during the meeting afterwards like that, this guy said, "Is there any other final comments that anybody would like to make before we close the meeting?" And I went, "Yeah, as a matter of fact, I don't want to spank anybody. It's not my job. But I got to tell you, y'all, I didn't feel real comfortable being here, and I certainly didn't feel welcome. And we're at the birthplace of Bill Wilson, and it just seems odd." And they kind of waved at me, and one guy talked for just a second, and then they all left, and it was just fine. Okay, so the end of this story is that about 4 months later, I'm in Fort Worth at the Legacy Group, not the Legacy Group. What's the name of that one over there? It's shit. It's not that far over. It's over there by those grain elevators. I can't remember it. But anyway, I get into the parking lot and I pull in there like that, and there must have been 20 or 30 people outside of this club. They have a big butt hut out there with a little pergolum out there, and they're all standing underneath there out of the sun smoking. And so I pull into my parking place there like this, and I get out, and I'm sitting here straightening my tie in the window of my truck like this, and all of a sudden I feel this arm around me like this, and I jumped and looked around like this, and all 20 of those people were standing in the parking lot with their arms around me, hugging me, and walked me into that meeting. And as soon as I got into that meeting, they introduced me to everybody that was inside the meeting, and it was like, I got to tell you, every day in this fellowship, we get to make a difference in how people perceive us, how people look at us. I mean, don't some of y'all get tired of all people in AA getting treated like we're some kind of downtrodden people sitting in a circle? TVs always do that stuff. There's one light swinging across the room above the thing like this, and everybody's looking at the floor like this, and it's like this. It's just crazy like that. At the center of this thing is an opportunity to pull people with an amazing vision of what recovery could actually look like. We're in a position where we could change lives on this stuff. And it is truly one of those game changers for me when I recognize that I could make a difference in the life of somebody, that I could make a difference in how they perceived our fellowship. I'm all in. Greeting people outside is my favorite thing to do at a meeting like that, because it's so tough sometimes. Some of y'all are from great big meetings, big full meetings with 100 cars in a parking lot like that. It's really intimidating when you pull up. I couldn't count how many cars I caught in that driveway, in that parking lot at Primary Purpose Group Dallas, getting ready to leave. They'd take 3 steps away from their car and go, and turn around and walk back to their car, get in to drive off, and I'm running like a bat out of hell trying to catch the car so I can tap on it like that and go, come on, and I can walk them inside. Let me tell you this real quick thing like that. One of the things that I started doing, there was this guy who was a golf pro, a junior golf pro. He was quite exceptional as a golfer. I'd sponsored him for about 2 years and had probably 100 conversations with him about how he treated people and what he was doing there like that. And I walked around the corner one day in this big courtyard outside our group like that, and my boy is over there giving golf lessons to some of the other guys that I sponsor. And they're standing over there, and he's teaching them how to swing, you know, like this and this sort of thing. And I when I walked around the corner, any of you guys ever live in Houston or places that had a lot of cockroaches? Like that, y'all ever been in a place like that where you flip on the light and 1,000 cockroaches run sideways like that? Well, y'all need to go practice some more. I mean, I'm just telling you that it's a game changer like that. Chris and I had a department. No, never mind. I won't tell you. But when I walked around that corner, those guys looked at me and saw me standing there like this, and all the guys that were looking my direction left like that. They were gone. And my little golf pro guy was standing there all by himself, just. And then he looks around, and I'm standing right behind him, and he goes, "Oh, Myers, hey, I was just trying to show these guys." I said, "That's okay. Let me just ask you a question, dude. Do you know everybody that's in that room right now? There's a big glass wall along that. I said, do you know everybody that's in there? And he goes, well, probably not. I mean, we're 40 minutes before the meeting starts, and there's already 50 or 60 people in that room. And he said, probably not. And I said, well, let me show you something. He said, no, I'll come in with you. I'll go. And I said, no, I want you to stand right here and just watch me. And he goes, oh, okay. I said, right here. And I pointed him to the thing, turned him this way, and he's looking through the glass window like that. I said, don't move, just watch me. And so I walk in like that, and I've done this 1,000 times, and it works. It never ceases to fail how effective it is. So I walk up. Let me just tell you, people that are reading a big book before the meeting are lonely. They're hung out. I'm just telling you like that. People don't come to a meeting to read a big book before the meeting like that. They're usually just hung out. And so I walk up to this guy, and I say, that's a pretty good book right there. And he goes, yeah, it is. I said, well, dude, what's your favorite part? Well, I don't know. I'm pretty new. I haven't even actually read it. No kid. Hey, let me show you what my favorite part is. And I take them to page 44 in We Agnostics. If when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely. It's the best qualifying paragraph in the big book like that. And I read it to him like that. And then we get to talk and laugh a little bit like this. And I said, dude, listen, in a couple of minutes, it's going to get really crowded in this meeting. And the meeting is a little complicated if you don't understand the format like that. Unless you're meeting somebody here, why don't you come sit with me? I'm right over there by that thing, by that coffee cup. And he guys goes, oh, okay, I'll do that. Like that, he gets up and walks over, and I'm looking around right there. There's another big book, and I walk over and I go, hey, that's a pretty cool book you got there. What's your favorite part? Could that be any stupider? I mean, really and truly like that. I mean, it's just, but it's amazing how many people you could help like that. So here it is. Within 15 minutes, I got five people sitting over by my cup like this, and I look over at my little golf pro guy looking at the window, and I just went like this, and there was a piece of me that wanted to go like this, but I didn't. I just kind of waved at him like this, and he goes, I get it like this. And so we sit over there, and I got me a whole bunch of little homies that are sitting right there with me, and they're happy, and I'm happy, and everybody, it's just a cool thing. So listen, that's a Tuesday night meeting. So on Thursday night, we got another repeat of that same meeting like that, and all these people are showing up again. Who do you think's their best friend? Me. I mean, I'm standing out there by the parking lot greeting people like this, and these people are getting out of the car going, hey, Myers, where are you sitting tonight? And pretty soon, it's just like, and there it starts. And it's just, we get a chance sometimes. Let me ask you, how many of y'all remember people in your life that were really kind to you when you were a kid? School teachers or people, and just it. We don't ever really forget those people that showed us that kind of kindness like that. We make this complicated about sponsorship, about all the other stuff that we're going to do. But I totally get it, totally dig it. But I got to tell you, at some point in time, wouldn't it be cool if we could just gently pull people with a vision of how amazing it is to be in this room with these people heading down the same path? It's a game changer. And we just, it's our way to feed before these people even know they're being fed. I mean, it's just the best thing in the universe. Guys, I love you, and I want you to understand, as a crusty old bastard looking back at his life, I do love the fact that I'm sober. I do. But in the bigger picture, in the middle of the night, when I'm just sitting there looking at the ceiling like that, the fact that I've been able to make a difference in the lives of little drunks and little dope fiends is immeasurable. It's just something that who would have thought to be able to look at your life and realize that it hadn't been so consumed by my selfish needs, wants, desires, all this other kind of stuff, that for just a while I could get out of my head and just simply move towards somebody that was hurting. And then you begin to realize over a period of time that some of these people never would have made it. Some of these people would have been dead if you had not done what you did. And that gets to be some heady stuff. I'm always available if you need me, guys, like that. And if there's anything I can do to help, again, I can't tell you how grateful I am that y'all asked me to come and do this. Thank y'all.